From KMXT and Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes. The cross-border watershed monitoring program has wrapped up, with Alaska and BC regulators concluding the project has run its course. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, tribes and scientists say there's still work to be done.
The Taku, Stikine, and Yunak are significant salmon-producing rivers. These fisheries are a key subsistence food source for Southeast Alaskans, and they're prized for the cash value for commercial and charter fleets. In 2015, Governor Walker signed a landmark agreement with British Columbia, pledging to study and monitor these transboundary watersheds that host a booming Canadian mining sector and Alaska's fisheries. That monitoring effort didn't get off the ground until 2017, and now Alaska and BC governments say their work is done. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation project manager Terry Lomax says the state developed valuable partnerships with British Columbia, but now there are other entities doing the monitoring, including the U.S. Geological Service.
So we did not want to be duplicative and want to truly just be efficient with all the resources. Didn't feel like it was necessary for multiple agencies to be collecting the same thing.
And it's the same story on the other side of the border, too. Greg Tamblyn heads BC's Environment Ministry's Regional Water Quality Section in Smithers.
Because these established sampling programs in the region, continuation of the joint sampling program would really be redundant.
Their final report says that 2 years of data found that water quality standards weren't exceeded on Alaska's side of the border. It found times when certain heavy metals were over limits in sediment, but noted there's a lot of naturally occurring minerals in the region. But scientists who've studied these watersheds say a couple of years is a blink of an eye for dynamic river systems.
You can't measure a given site once or twice a year for 2 years and claim that you know the baseline watershed health of that area.
Chris Sargent is a freshwater ecologist with the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station. The final report noted there was little evidence of contamination and aquatic life appeared healthy. But Sargent says many of the mines that Alaskans downstream are worried about haven't been built yet.
You know, the way I look at this is we have a lot of potential mines coming down the pike that are very large projects that could be built in the near future. And so I'm looking at like, well, do we know what these metal patterns look like right now in these rivers in case those big projects are built and things change? And I just don't think we're set up for success to answer that question yet.
It was Southeast Alaska tribes that helped spur the Walker administration to engage BC over transboundary mining. And they say the work has been short-lived. Fred Olson Jr. heads the 15 Tribe Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission.
We definitely need water quality sampling, but we need ongoing, seasonal, sustainable sampling. We don't need a couple years of hit and miss, cherry picking the data, and then saying everything's okay.
But Alaska and BC will still collaborate. Its bilateral working group, established during the Walker administration, will continue to meet twice a year. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. 1-800-992-4960 or online at alaskaboat.com.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their family. AMSEA at amsea.org or 907-747-3287.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvests for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
This just in from KBBI's Jay Barrett. In an effort to reach more conservative Americans with a message about mask wearing, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has reached out to a couple of skippers from the Alaska-based reality TV show Deadliest Catch. The Discovery Channel hit show has a sizable following among conservative white men and women. As first reported by the news website Axios, Sig Hansen and Josh Harris of the fishing vessels Northwestern and Cornelia Marie, respectively, talk about the need to wear masks for protection, set to dramatic scenes from the show.
Being a ship captain means being prepared for anything.
We're the ones responsible for making sure the crew makes it aboard safe and sound.
We have one of the most dangerous jobs on the planet. Right now, it's dangerous everywhere. So when medical experts say to wear your mask to fight the pandemic, wear your mask.
Sig and Josh are right. Safety comes first, and the best way to prevent the spread of COVID is to wear your mask. Mask up, America.
Oh, yeah.
I like that.
Cook Inlet belugas used to follow salmon through the Kenai River in the summer. Now they're mostly spotted in other seasons. Researchers from NOAA Fisheries aren't sure why, and it's one of many questions they're asking about the endangered population to better understand why belugas aren't rebounding and how the agency can support their recovery. As Sabine Pooks in Kenai reports, a relatively new DNA sampling technique might help them find answers.
NOAA Fisheries geneticist Kim Parsons, who's leading the project, says it's like getting clues from a crime scene.
All organisms are continually shedding genetic material into their environment. So in the soil, in the air, and in the water, there are all these cells floating around that represent the community of organisms that are in the water at that time.
It's called environmental DNA, or eDNA. As they swim through the Kenai River, fish shed tiny bits of eDNA in skin cells, feces, even mucus. Researchers are collecting this eDNA from the river to understand which species of fish are there. They're looking at fish because that's what belugas eat. Scientists say knowing more about the beluga's diet will help them understand how they're sustaining themselves in the winter and what's keeping their population from rebounding.
So that we can try and learn a little bit more about how the beluga movements are responding to changes in the prey base.
eDNA is a relatively new concept. Alaska researchers have previously collected and sequenced samples of eDNA to study Pacific salmon and harbor porpoise. To collect samples from the Kenai River, NOAA partnered with a field team from the Ketchumek Bay campus of Kenai Peninsula College. KPC biology professor Debbie Bogie Tobin is leading that team. She says, on one hand, the fact that the whales are in the river at all could be a promising sign that there's enough prey there to support them through the winter.
But it also makes me nervous because we know that at times of the year when there's lots of potential prey there, like in the summertime, they don't seem to be using it. And that question puzzles me.
Once or twice a month, Bogie Tobin and a team of students take water samples from two spots on the Kenai River, at the city docks and Warren Ames Bridge. They collect samples both at the river's surface and a few meters down, so they can capture a wide range of genetic signatures. The river water, containing low levels of eDNA, is emptied into something as simple as a sterile Nalgene, Parsons says.
It's low tech, it's accessible, and we can collect a lot of samples that way. We just require, you know, a hardy field team who's willing to go out there in all kinds of conditions to lower the bottle for us off the dock or the boat or the bridge, wherever we're sampling from.
Bogie Tobin and her team started collecting samples in November. They'll keep collecting until May. Once they've filled their vials, the team runs the water it's collected through a filter in a lab in Homer. The remaining material goes to Parsons in Seattle for sequencing. There, they can use it to identify and quantify the prey species in the river. It's a pilot study, so it's relatively preliminary. eDNA is not a perfect science yet, Parsons says.
The tricky thing about eDNA is that we're still in the early stages of understanding how that signal moves in the environment.
In a river, researchers can capture genetic signals as they move downstream. In a marine environment, that material is moved by wind and currents and could settle and sink. If researchers find the eDNA methodology successful, they can take what they've learned and apply it to other sites in Cook Inlet. Bogie Tobin also says they can use the data they collect to set some measures to protect the belugas.
So hopefully if we find out when they're relying on the river, on the Kenai River in this case, we could potentially put in place some sort of management policies or measures to, you know, set aside some of that habitat for them.
Researchers say they'll have preliminary analysis by the end of the year. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The hearings conducted by the Coast Guard into the sinking of the Scandies Rose on New Year's Eve in 2019 are wrapping up this week. Among the questions asked was why they left port with the poor weather forecast. Here is surviving crewman Dean Gribble.
So speaking of weather, any discussion on weather prior to departure?
Oh, yeah. We knew it was going to be crap.
Anyone express any concerns about
it? We all did. That's what we all did. It was like, well, you know, it's kind of dumb to go out. It's a hurricane. But they, you know, the cod season starts on January 1st, and we had like 3 or 4 day run, so we were already going to be late. And this might be the last derby year of the cod fisheries. So, and they go off catch history to get more quota. So it was really crucial to get there and get as much pounds as we could.
Okay. Amongst the crew, who would you say was the most concerned about departing in that weather?
I know me and John talked about it a few times. Me and Gary was too. I mean, we knew we were going out in the weather. It was kind of dumb. We should have waited 12 hours or whatever.
And so you mentioned the derby. Can you describe that a little more for us, the derby fisheries?
Yeah, the cod fishery now is still considered a derby. So there's a set quota that, you know, all the boats fish off of, in opposed to individual fish quota, where the quota is divvied out to each boat. Each boat has its own individual amount of catch that they're allowed. How they did for the crab, they went off the previous history catch. So if you, you know, had bad years the last couple of years when they were doing the search, you had bad quota. So they wanted to make sure to get quota, which was my understanding. It was a big concern here. It was talking about it, and a lot of concern that we leave coming from down south, that we get out of town. I mean, they, like I said, they wanted me to fly up the 28th. They wanted to leave like as soon as possible.
Every boat fishing that season was driven by the possibility that he was not just fishing for cod, but also for something infinitely more valuable, something that's only caught during the qualifying years of an imminent catch share program, catch history that could translate into quota shares later.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund, which recognizes the importance of Alaska's sustainable fisheries to the state's economy.
Thanks this week go out to Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick, KBBI's Jay Barrett, and KDLL's Sabine Pooks. Good fishing, everyone. This music is by Craig Padilla and Marvin Allen. Listen for more in future shows.